we are, yeah.
Okay. We're in a regular meeting in public workshop, North Bend Planning Commission, Thursday, May 10, 2012, at City Hall, 701. Minutes, April 12, 2012 Planning Commission meeting. Motion to approve.
Motion to approve.
Second. Comments, corrections? All in favor?
Aye.
Motion carries. Before we move into public comment on non-agenda, we also have the upcoming tentative schedule there. And I just wanted to ask Mike for introduction of the urban forestry piece.
Yeah.
If I'm assuming there'll be a document that goes with that. Is that going to be ready well ahead of time?
It'll go out with the Planning Commission packet. Are you looking for more time?
Well, it'd be nice. Well, depends on, I guess, how extensive it is, but it's pretty tough. Yeah, this was...
Yeah, it's not anything like this.
Yeah.
What it is we got a grant from the Department of Natural Resources to do a tree inventory and an urban forestry plan. So the urban forestry plan is basically how are you caring for all of your public trees, the trees within rights-of-way, trees within parks, dealing with replacement, maintenance issues.
Okay.
So what we've done is put some of the maintenance stuff into the plan, and things regarding street trees, about if you want to take out a street tree, plant a street tree, it's a free permit that we've established just to make sure people don't go and hack a street tree off and there's no recourse.
Right.
So the street tree regulations are the component of that that comes to the code, and that's what we need to review.
Okay. So, okay. Yeah, because the question was, yeah, we could get early. This is pretty tough. It depends on my schedule, but often it seems like I'm seeing the day of instead of. So, yeah. Okay. Well, that was just my question.
It's not you, Mike. It's not you.
Next agenda is public comment on non-agenda items.
I just want to make notice on June 28th that it might be a planned absence for me, as I am expecting a child sometime around that.
Okay, you are. Hey, good showing.
Yeah, you don't look like
sorry.
It. Gotta get to work.
My wife is.
Oh. That's great.
But I
do somewhere around there.
I have gained. It's just I'm trying to layer, so it's not as evident.
That's cool. So you're giving well forewarned notice you might not make the end of June meeting.
Yes, sir. Exciting notice because it is.
I don't want to be blacklisted.
You'll be selling your bike, I take it.
No. This would be number two.
Oh. Good advance.
Deal.
Putting that little kid here.
I was told no on that.
I have it now.
Okay, public comment and non-agenda, seeing no public, we'll move on from there. Energy and Sustainability Workshop, second in the series, Green Building Programs and Low Impact Stormwater Management.
Well, sad there's no public for the workshop.
I know.
Yeah, the sun's out.
Yeah.
Where's the thermostat for that building here?
Yeah.
You want it up?
I can't move away from these guys. It's cold.
Well, I did.
It's like going right here. Mr. How's Mr. Beatty? He's still our historian, right?
Dave Batty.
Yeah.
Beatty Batty, I'm sorry.
Oh, wasn't there something with some recognition?
Yeah, by the city's Sagomi and North.
Yeah. That's nice, too.
Yeah. He's a great guy. So, this is the second in our workshop, and this is more for the public. I wanted to just touch back to this if there was members of the public here about why we're doing this, the requirements of the state, just that it's important to consider for our own community as well, and that we want to be adaptable to changes in the future. Coming back to the keys of success for North Bend is that we really are small, have the ability to do a lot of complex things, and need to keep our time efficient and limited staff. So where we're at in the series, We already introduced it last month, and we're going to cover green building and site-specific low-impact stormwater management at this workshop. June 14th, we'll address resource consumption. July 12th will be our last workshop, urban forestry, greenhouse gas emissions. And then following that, all along, I'm taking notes about public comment received, your comments, any comments from staff, et cetera. And then we bring those revisions back to you for consideration based on those comments. And we'll move forward from there.
So we'll do it all as one.
Yeah. Move forward from there for a final hearing and hopefully take it out to council probably early August.
So I noticed that in kind of the look forward, and it, you know, following the workshops, it seemed to be you're planning to bring it back as a whole and have potential action on it that same night.
No,
that
seems
a little
night.
Aggressive.
I think we want to have another meeting in there.
Yeah. For okay.
Getting through all.
Yeah, that's how I wanted to be sure and ask about that.
Yeah, great.
Thank you.
Okay, so green building. Was anybody here on the Planning Commission when we did a green building workshop with Bill Green? I think Jim, you were here.
Yeah.
That was about 2.5-3 years ago.
Been here. I'm not recalling.
Okay. Yeah.
Now we're picking up a little bit.
You here for the workshop?
Yeah, okay.
Just getting started.
I'm very big girl. I'll be here actually for the second half, but I'd rather be here over in late.
All right. Good. I thought so.
Oh, yeah. Feel free. It is getting warm in here. You just turn the heater down, but it's.
We just need to go here for anyway. Okay.
I'm gonna back up a couple steps. We got more people coming in now. Thanks for coming. So we just got started, but I'm gonna take a couple steps back to just a brief introduction to where we're at with sustainability workshops. So the reasons that we're doing a sustainability element to our comprehensive plan, three primary reasons. First of all, there are some state requirements to address greenhouse gas emission reductions. There's grants that the city is eligible for if we have greenhouse gas reduction policies in place. Those are state grants from basically from any state organization offering competitive grant funds. They have to consider as a part of their evaluation criteria for grants. And these are big grants, like Transportation Improvement Board grants, Public Works Trust Fund loans and grants, big sources of money for state for city operations. Some of their review criteria are whether or not we have policies in place that address greenhouse gas emissions reduction. That's one of the big requirements. Also requirements that we've touched on at our previous workshop about transitioning to alternative energy sources for vehicles. There's a state requirement to do that by 2018. And also just that it's the right thing to do as a community. We want to consider our long-term future, both from a budget and an environmental standpoint. And we want to be prepared for change. Change is always inevitable. And if you're prepared for change, you're better off in the long term. In North Bend, we want to keep it simple. We have really limited staffing, limited budget in a small city. We want to be efficient with the time that we have and keep it as non-burdensome as possible for the development community. As a result, we also want to rely on as much incentive basis rather than regulatory basis as possible. So at our April 12th workshop, we introduced, gave a broader introduction to why we're doing the work, the series in the sustainability element to our health plan. And we looked at fossil fuel, water, and energy use in conservation, both in our city operations and in the community as a whole.
In this workshop, we're going to look at green building techniques. What are some of the green building programs out there? Why is it something that different cities are addressing? Why is it a growing market issue? And then as well as stormwater, low-impact stormwater management. That's changing how we address stormwater and what are ways that we can continue to move in a lower impact direction. We'll have two more workshops in addition on June 14th and July 12th. And during all this time, I'm going to be taking notes of comment received from the public. We'll be coming back to the Planning Commission following those workshops and working through amendments to the draft. We have our draft available on our city website that has the full policy proposal on it. And we'll come back after our July 12th workshop and work through amendments based on the comments received. So green building, just a quick introduction of what it typically includes. You hear a lot about green building these days. If you have to sum it up into four main points, it's about energy efficiency, making your buildings as energy efficient as possible through insulation, through fixtures, through appliances. Same thing with water use, your fixtures, the appliances, your irrigation schemes. Materials that go into the building, low toxicity, recyclable content, disposal as well during the construction period, and the site design. That's a broader consideration beyond just the building itself. How well is it integrated into the community that promotes walkability, bicycle use, densities that can promote transit use, alternatives to single occupant vehicle trips to reduce overall fuel use and consequently get greenhouse gas emissions. So it's growing very quickly. I think just if you look at greenwashing as a concept, the idea of promoting things as sustainable, even if they're not, shows what a strong market demand there is for sustainability as a whole. The growth sector in the green building market has been absolutely phenomenal. So you're all aware about the tanking of the housing market and the real estate market. The green building industry at the same time has grown. So from 2008 to 2010, green building construction starts were up 50%. That's a statistic from McGraw-Hill Construction. And Built Green is now certifying, Built Green is one of the programs that we'll look at for residential certification. They're now certifying 30% of the residential market in King County. And that's only Built Green, that's not considering the lead residential or other certification programs. Yeah?
What's Built Green?
It's a green construction certification program. So I'll go into it a little bit more. So what it is it's a non-profit third-party organization that evaluates the construction of homes for a builder based on all sorts of different criteria. So site-specific criteria, energy use, water use, and gives it a ranking. And depending on the ranking, you can achieve either a 3-star, a 4-star, or a 5-star. So builders find that valuable as a marketing tool to respond to the growing demand for green or sustainable housing. So why is it gaining steam? I think, first of all, it's because there's a desire among the general public to reduce their own environmental impacts. Buildings, again, represent, it's one of the largest sources of greenhouse gas emissions, the need to heat and cool buildings. 20% in Washington. Nationally, it's actually much higher than that. And that's because our energy here comes from hydropower, so that's naturally a lower greenhouse gas emission emitting source of power. Other popular reasons is it's the perception and the reality that it's a healthier environment to live in. Green buildings typically have, part of the certification is low toxicity, so your carpets have less volatile organic compounds, less solvents and things in the paints and materials. And
people want to reduce their exposure to harmful chemicals. A third factor of why the movement is gaining steam in popularity is the long-term cost savings. So over time, green construction typically costs a little bit more. 2% is a common value, but over the time of a building's life, the U.S. Green Building Council has found that it's a savings of 20%, or more than 10 times the initial investment. One example that we have locally is the Mount Si High School last year replaced their heating system with a geothermal heating system. And just with that one replacement alone, they expect to save $125,000 annually on their heating costs at the high school.
Run that back again. That started when?
Last year.
Stalling. So it's going through the winter.
A good one, too.
So do we have a real number for the winter, or is it still projected?
I don't have that. I got that from the Valley Record last year. Yeah. Actually, a year and a half ago now.
I don't know. I was trying to recall, too, that I remember the article as with most of these things, the upfront cost was, of course, substantial in replacement. I won't cite a figure. I know it was higher than traditional replacements that they were looking at, but the annualized and long-term savings versus traditional was substantial as well. So it's just the 125. It's a great number, but it's hard to get it in the context of what's the payback period, and their payback was reasonably short, if I recall.
I wonder what their overall total bill is. If that's a savings.
Holy crap! Yeah, it's huge.
So that represents both the residential side and the commercial side. We're seeing growth in both sectors.
So, Mike, I ask from the way the green building is used, it's sort of any combination of.
Yeah, it's basically your choice,
right?
The developer's choice. It's a whole toolkit of things that you can do to achieve points in all those different factors. So water use, energy use, etc.
So a particular product might not be, say, necessarily all that environmentally friendly, but if it's representing a substantial difference in energy use, that would still qualify.
Yeah, it's an outcome-based model rather than a prescriptive.
Right. Yeah, that's good. Thanks.
So the state legislature 2 years ago recognized the value in green construction, particularly with the long-term cost savings and the health benefits to the occupants of the buildings and to the state in particular with a long-term budget. So they passed Revised Code of Washington 3935D, which requires all major project facility or major facility projects, which is essentially primary public buildings. We're not talking about maintenance sheds and things like that, but buildings that are open substantially to the public that are greater than 5,000 square feet. These are required now to achieve at least LEED Silver standard. And that includes all school districts that receive public funding from the state, which is all public school districts, and anyone else that has a major project, major facility project that is receiving funds from the state capital budget. So if you've got a big city hall and you've got the state's paying for part of that, or some other large public project building, it has to meet the LEED Silver standard.
What's the target for the new fire station?
I don't believe we received any state funds for that.
What's our target
in terms of green certification? We didn't go out after green certification. The direction was to go for as many sustainable features as possible within the budget provided. So that's what we did. Focused on low impact stormwater management, natural landscaping, added insulation, probably site number of additional features.
Do you know if they have an air circulation system I know in Issaquah and in some of the fire stations that they do, the union mandates that they have that because of the diesel exhaust and so many firemen coming out with lung cancer as a cause of the exhaust and trapped inside their firehouses. So.
Well, all the truck exhaust systems, I think that's mandated.
Some of them kick on when they get close to the house before the door pulls up. Downtown, that is about.
I don't know. Ron might know on that one, but I think you're right, Robin.
Sorry, I wasn't paying attention. I'm doing something else. So
the question about the fire station, if there's some sort of exhaust and ventilation system that kicks on when the vehicles come in or are started up?
Each of the vehicles will have an exhaust system that hooks into each exhaust muffler or whatever, so that the stuff does not stay inside the bay, but it will exhaust up into the atmosphere after that. It doesn't treat it or anything like that.
Now, is there any other green qualification things that are being thought of for the building?
For the building.
Such as in the paint? Or
So where we directed got on to was Mike was talking to us about LEED Silver standard that the state's pushing. He said, and the new fire station, what are we targeting? And he pointed out that we weren't necessarily going after state funding, but the question still remains, if we're targeting better practices, what are we going after in our probably our only new municipal building for some time?
We did ask for green type of installation on the fire stations, only to the extent that that investment would have a reasonable return on it, as opposed to putting something in where our return will be 50 or 60 years long. It's not a good return on an investment. So if it has something in the order of maybe 20 years, then yeah, we're doing things like that. Some of the air conditioning systems in there will be automated so that you don't get human error in operating it or somebody forgetting how to do something or whatever. We have automatic lighting in there to basically based on motion sensors. What else do we have in there? We don't have solar energy or anything like that. We're doing yard or sort of green environmental handling of stormwater infiltration into the existing aquifer and not running it off onto into the storm system offsite. What else?
Is there a passive?
I'm sure there are other things, but
is the architectural features taking into account passive solar opportunities?
For it just does not have an adequate return on our investment for you. With the limited amount of funds that we have, $5 million for the entire thing.
There were additional features that the architect looked into, like a cistern system that would have collected the roof water and reused that for washing the vehicles. But again, it came back down to the ROI. Honestly, it wasn't suitable for the budget.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah.
I wasn't clear when you said that the state building, like the government-funded buildings, when they have something that needs to be fixed, do they have to meet these requirements? Or if they do, then they get more money?
No, this applies to new buildings and substantial renovation projects. So anytime there's a new building, this does apply, 5,000 square feet or greater. And there's criteria about what meets a substantial reconstruction project, a certain percentage over the assessed value of the existing building. And then it does have to meet the new portion of the building anyway has to meet. So that's a model that this was one of the first LEED requirements in the nation.
since, a lot of other cities throughout the country have used the same kind of 5,000 square foot threshold as the same model for their own practices.
So with the state setting up, this is a model practice, and then of course their stick only applies if they're funding. Mm-hmm. But are we considering, are you suggesting that maybe the city ought to look at adopting it as a model of whether or not there is state funding?
That's something that the Planning Commission considered. It is a proposed policy for our own buildings, our own practices, and that will just have to be considered by the Planning Commission and the Council. But towards the end, I'll give you just a listing of the number of cities in Washington that have done this, and that's just a quick what I know of list, and it's very extensive. So it seems that a majority of cities are now using this for their own.
Tied to state funding.
Right? No, not tied to state funding. Just to say that we're going to lead by example in our next city hall or our next fire station or whatever it is going to meet LEED Silver. We feel it's important. Dallas, Texas, as an example, is not even doing it for their own buildings. They're just saying all new residential construction and all new commercial construction is going to meet LEED Silver. Just period. So different programs that are certification for green construction methods. There's quite a few out there. I'm focusing on just the ones that would apply more to North Bend. First one, water sense certification. This is administered by the EPA. Each of these certification programs is a point-based system. So again, it's a toolbox by which the developer can choose multiple methods to get to the desired level of points. This obviously addresses water conservation issues, your landscape design, things about how far your hot water tank is from the faucet or the shower to reduce that amount of wasted water while you're trying to warm up the shower. And then homeowner outreach as well. Salmon Safe is a more recent certification, and it's focused on stormwater management. So how is the development overall affecting stormwater runoff, infiltration to aquifers, as well as more of the physical environment component of buffers and stream restoration?
So private nonprofit stewardship partners, this is a King County, a state, a regional?
Regional. They're based, I believe, in Portland. Energy SAR certification, it's EPA and Department of Energy. And just like you have your Energy Star appliances, you've seen them at the department stores, they also certify homes. So the homes, when they meet at least 15% higher energy than the 2004 International Residential Code. And I talked to Russ, our building official, about why is it 2004 and not the current, and he says it's basically the same thing, they just haven't upped their internal program. But it's focused on energy efficiency, so however you can save energy through heating, through your appliances, through insulation, you can achieve points and get up to that 15% higher threshold and get the Energy Star certification. Built Green is the primary residential program that you see in this area, and it's a program of the Mass Builders Association of King and Snohomish County. This is a comprehensive program as opposed to the previous three that we looked at. Those three are focused on one particular aspect of sustainability. This covers the gamut. So under Built Green, you can achieve 3 stars, 4 stars, or 5 stars, depending on your level of achievement. Most of the builders around here can easily achieve a 3-star. John Day Homes, Tannerwood, achieves 3-star, as an example. So most of the time that you see incentives for a green residential program, they're usually in the 4 or 5 star range because it's otherwise too easy to achieve. LEED, Leadership in Energy and Efficient or Environmental Design, is the principal commercial certification program, although they're now branching into residential and LEED communities as well. So again, a point-based system,
You see lead silver, lead gold, and lead platinum. And this is, again, comprehensive, so it addresses energy efficiency, water use, the materials within the building, and the building's relationship to its site. So walkability, stormwater management, all the different factors.
In the new program, are they applying the same criteria, the same levels? It's
still,
for the residential and the remodels, it's still silver gold.
Yeah. So what are we doing currently with regard to encouraging green or environmentally sustainable buildings? So first of all, our commercial design standards, we have floor area ratio requirements for commercial buildings. Floor area ratio is just the amount of area of the building in relation to the area of the site. And we allow incentives to increase your floor area ratio for a number of factors there. So if you're providing pervious paving, green roofs, sunscreens, green gardens, those give you points to increase your floor area ratio. And we also got a number of low-impact development stormwater features that we'll get to in the second part of the presentation here.
Mike, help me with sunscreens.
It's
not intuitive for here.
It can be in the summertime if you've got a high solar exposure. There's a number of, I believe there's a number of buildings over in the Snoqualmie Ridge Business Park that have implemented sunscreens to just reduce the amount of
eliminate solar gain through glass or whatever.
So the solar insulation then is hitting the sunscreen and radiating heat off of that as opposed to the window and coming in. So what are popular ways that cities are incentivizing green building? So the reason of why should we do this in the first place comes back to it's the primary reasons that we're addressing sustainability as a whole. It's the right thing to do in the context of environmental change, in the context of providing longevity and value of our community. The principal one is time. Builders are always wanting to get their projects processed as quickly as possible so they can be responsive to the market. A lot of jurisdictions provide priority permit processing for buildings that have been certified as green. So you get to go to the front of the line and everybody else bumps back just a little bit. I gave a few examples in there. Those are just ones that I'm familiar with. There's a lot more than what I'm familiar with. Cost is another opportunity. So you can revise your permit fee schedule so that it gives a smaller rate to certified buildings and makes up the difference by a very slight higher rate to non-certified buildings. Developability bonuses, if that includes your density, you can give, if you're allowed 4 units per acre, maybe you go to 4.3 units per acre or something if your project is LEED certified or if you have built green certified homes within the community. Other things are unit type flexibility. If it's just a single family residential zone, maybe you allow a certain percentage of attached or townhomes within that. For commercial, a parking requirement reduction is a common tool. Promotion is also a way to provide an incentive to builders. They're always looking for ways to market their communities, and some cities will offer green awards by which they give the development a connection from their website and say, you've been awarded our green community of the year. Just a little bit more they can put in their advertising campaign. And then leading by example. So again, where cities reflect the state standard that the state established in their own practices. So those are just a few of the jurisdictions that have done that, that have committed to future buildings meeting that state silver standard. A lot of those have met far more than LEED silver standard. Some have met LEED gold, LEED platinum, and their city halls and other public buildings. So these are the proposed policies that we have in our draft energy and sustainability element. So it's reflecting what we talked about there. The first one, setting the example to the community by creating a standard that we're applying to our own buildings, not to the general public, not to the market, but to city buildings that we build in the future. The second part is incentives for the private sector. We're not asking for a required certification by the private sector, but just incentives, like we just talked about, to encourage it. And then the third one, just identifying and removing barriers to implementing green practices. So there's a lot of things in codes that, without thinking about it, can discourage green building. Like your road standards often have got requirements for curbs, planter strips that can prohibit low-impact stormwater development. There's a lot of things that you're not thinking about until you really start digging in and seeing how things work.
So, Mike, if we're proposing that the first one, that the city, leads by example, shouldn't we be very cognizant of what, regardless of whether the fire station is getting public money or not, that, or state money or whatever, that we know that we're meeting this, or we're at least staying close, and if we're not? I mean, it's just right. So hypocritical if we're not.
Well, at this point, we're not. We have no policy direction for doing it.
But I feel like if we're going to put it out there and we're building this, this big new fire station, that it's just somewhat hypocritical in my brain that we're talking about this now. We haven't done this. So I feel like before we say, yes, we're going to do that, we need to know what is happening with the fire station, just so that I feel comfortable to say, okay, well, maybe we're not quite there, but I'm okay with that, but not knowing. And then after we put it out that we weren't even close would just be bad.
Well, the fire station started as a project well before this process.
No, I get that.
But
I totally get that.
Yeah, we understand that policy's not in place, that we're just beginning to talk about it. The concepts and the lead from the state and the types of things we're looking to incorporate are all well known to us and have been in place. I guess, as you mentioned earlier, so the city did not evaluate the project based on lead. They're not intending to apply for it. It would still seem to be quite within our grasp to have it evaluated. If we were to apply, it would likely fall into the range of X.
Okay, to consider what the likelihood of achieving it standard would be.
Right.
Well, just to know, it gives us the ground to stand on to say, so this is what we're going to do going forward, and if we felt like this project, we didn't have enough money to meet this, like I get that, but what makes you think that we would have enough money if we had to rebuild City Hall, that we'd be able to do that in the future? So,
lessons learned evaluation, since that bond is done and over, or of course there's always potential for additional, but probably not in this case. But it would be an understanding. Does the public understand the trade-offs?
Right.
Would they have gone for a 5-5, 6-0 bond if indeed the evaluation said, and the payoff will be X? Weren't really offered that opportunity, and so we all get that we went to bond in a bad economic time. We got it. We're moving forward. No doubt we're doing the right thing, getting the project moving forward. But it's the evaluation of, and did we miss an opportunity?
Yeah, it would be relatively easy to run through the checklist of lead to find out how we would have scored. To actually get the scoring requires that third-party certification.
Right. At least if we know conceptually if we're near or far from that. And, I mean, if we are...
Well, if it's beyond 2004, should we already qualify for something like that? Should 2004 building specs?
Oh, is it energy one?
Yeah.
Depending on how... The state energy code is not in the international energy code. They're the state is working on that right now to adopt the International Energy Code. We've had our own separate model for many, many years. So it's not as easy a comparison with energy, but the other checklist, the lead checklist, would probably be too hard to come through and have it support.
Yeah, it'd be nice to know.
It's the puzzle, too, that strikes me.
Oh, yeah, politics.
Why were you asleep at the wheel?
Why didn't you go out
there? Yeah. Someone's going to ask.
I can't visualize the plans in my head. I've looked at them a couple times. But what's the total square footage, you know, off the top of your head?
19,000? Is that?
Call it 20?
Ron, you call it square footage at the fire station?
He's trying to work here. I believe that including the bay is 14,000 square feet. Okay.
And so it is two stories of?
No, one story.
All one story.
All one story.
And we've got kind of a living quarters over the
office
kitchen thing. What?
I'm sorry, I'm getting. I can't hear you with the double conversation.
So we've got office, living quarters, and kitchen and whatever else. It's all in one sort of area.
Right.
It's all one story.
Yeah.
And then we've got the five bays, and we have a storage area next to that for hoses and other equipment and whatever else.
So is it fair to say half the square footage you just used, something around how many, 19,000?
14,000 for this entire place. Probably the living quarters is probably two-fifths of that.
Okay. So the majority of the building, square footage we're talking about, is bays.
Bays, that's right.
Warehouse space. So part of me is thinking if that's important, but because of that skew, I don't know how many warehouses are going to get LEED certified.
There's quite a few, actually.
Okay. Well, does that make it easy? Is it easy to do in that regard?
And we just have to look at the criteria.
I'm just curious.
I immediately thought of the place that that we talked about that night, that we had changed the adjusted some stuff for the little commercial place that's going to go down at Mount Si Road, and that was like, was that 20,000 square feet?
The antique place?
No, the where the little coffee stand is. They're going to put in the little widget maker. It's a company in this factory. It's a small company. Who is it?
It's a plastic composite manufacturer.
Well, who their tenant is. It might not necessarily be them. That's why they approved it for manufacturing.
But that was for 20,000 square feet. I was like, oh, wonder how they could, being a manufacturing warehouse.
Did you have a question?
Well, I have a comment and then a question. It seems like if it's mostly warehouse space, it would be easier to make it green. It seems that it would be easier. And then my question is, since this is still on paper, wouldn't it be, how easy is it to adjust it?
The fire station design has been approved, and we're getting ready for construction at this point. So.
We'll be opening up bids next week.
Yeah,
June. So it's already gone. Technically, it's too late. But what would it take to put it back on the paper and reconsider?
You got big bucks.
Yeah.
Well, it depends how your bids come in, doesn't it, Ron?
That's right.
And that would change.
Give them incentives.
Quite seriously. I mean, you're going to have a construction reserve, I'm sure, and you don't know what will happen with the bids.
The reserve is already built into the budget.
Right.
So we really don't, per se, would have a reserve anymore. You usually have a reserve during the planning and design phase until you really know what you're wanting to get. And then you go out to bid, you don't have any reserve left. So you're hoping now that the bids are going to stay underneath our projected budget. And we have add-ons.
You're building a project without contingency.
No.
Good. It's that tight of budget. That's why we have in the bid document, we have deductive alternates and additive alternates, depending upon how the bids come in for the base
right.
project we want. If we get a good price, and we have some additional money left over, we'll use some of those additive alternates to provide some additional elements in there that we want. If we get a little bit over, then we're going to have some deductive alternates, like maybe instead of 5 bays, we crunch it down to 4 bays. So we have these contingencies in the bid, but not as a reserve money sitting out there.
And I think there were some sustainability-related additive alternates. There was an insulation alternate that increased the insulated value of the building, where depending on if they put it up against the ceiling versus the...
That part, in the roof.
I guess the main point, as you're saying, yes, very tight, you're not anticipating that you'll get to do a whole lot with additives and alts, but
sure,
through any project, you'll have opportunity for change orders for potential changes, and then you'll need to evaluate which ones are more important.
Mm-hmm. But we do have a potential for a new city hall coming up in the next several years, so this would definitely apply to that project if this were a policy to provide direction to the city. Okay. So a low-impact stormwater management. Just to give you a brief understanding of the history of stormwater management, and we'll get into what low-impact stormwater management actually is and how we're using it in North Bend. So before the 1980s, we were just trying to get rid of stormwater as quickly as possible. Just keep it from ponding, get it out of your backyard. So that was what that obviously resulted in is anything that was in the stormwater, driven from your car, from your lawnmower, from your pesticides, just went directly into the stream. Terrible for fish, terrible for flash flooding, and just led to a lot of pollution problems. Stormwater is considered the most environmentally damaging issue in our state now by the Department of in the 1980s, we moved into a new model of detaining stormwater, so just instead of piping it directly out to the river, you saw the proliferation of all these stormwater ponds everywhere. Typically very ugly, not something that you want to see in your backyard. Usually they're surrounded by blackberries and scotch broom. But what the idea was, slow down the stormwater so that it could, over time, gradually move out to the river and not cause the flash flooding problem. Later on, that progressed into multiple pond stormwater systems so that you're also getting a little bit of water quality treatment out of it. So the settlement can occur, goes to the next pond settlement, and then cleaner water out to the river. But what all that was very expensive, a lot of pipes, a lot of piping, a lot of expense, and also a lot of maintenance. So not good for the budget. But the new approach is to get rid of the pipes and the ponds and all the complexity of that and try to go back to a model that we see in nature with the natural forest around us, where everything, all the stormwater, because of the great infiltration capacity of the soils in native forests, you don't see it running off when it rains, it just goes straight in. So we're trying to mimic this on development sites now, with on-site features that infiltrate the water. So there's a number of ways that happens. All of this is referred to as LID, or low-impact development stormwater management techniques. And the first and biggest technique is just to minimize the impervious surface in the first place. So you're minimizing your clearing. If you look at that picture of the Maple Valley Library, that's an absolutely beautiful building if you haven't ever been there. But there's basically no landscaping. They just carve areas out of the forest to place the building, to place the parking, and the pathways, and otherwise you're in the middle of the forest. Pervious asphalt and paver blocks are another way to minimize impervious surface, even in an area where you typically would need impervious surface. So the water can just drain straight through the paving instead of being channeled to pipes.
Yeah, do we have any nearby examples of the pervious asphalt?
Yeah, Issaquah. If you go to downtown Issaquah, they repaved a big chunk of, I don't remember the name of the street, it's the street that's just behind their main street through downtown.
Front?
It's the one behind Front Street.
Okay.
That's impervious asphalt paved street.
Okay.
And then I believe Sammamish has a number of examples as well. And actually most of their sidewalks in Sammamish now are impervious concrete. The newer sidewalks.
With paper blocks, do they have any issues still with ice buildup? So, especially in our area where we get often snow then rain then freeze, if that could create more of a driving hazard than, you know, versus pervious asphalt, you might favor one or the other.
If it didn't have drainage, like proper drainage, I imagine that'd be a problem. But the intent is that the water's just going straight through, so it doesn't pond and create that. But I imagine that is a problem in some areas.
So we just think also for like plowing and stuff too.
Snoqualmie did a little small strip of paver blocks at their fire station just to test it. Yeah. It's 8 years old now and it's still in fine shape.
Well, if it's done right, there's plenty of evidence for brick roads all over the place.
Sure.
It lasts forever.
I was just thinking,
put together properly. Mm-hmm.
So I was in Nantucket this week. And talk about a nightmare if you were going to pave or plow.
Plow, yeah, I'm sure they do.
But it's a great traffic calming feature.
So beyond just minimizing impervious surfaces, you can actually collect the stormwater as well. So this is where you see on a small scale things like rain barrels for your own garden use. Green roofs, that's the Ballard Library, where you're collecting the stormwater from the roof and just using it on the roof to grow vegetation so that it goes through evapotranspiration. Cisterns on a larger scale, and that's often channeled to non-potable domestic use, flushing toilets, hoses for the garden, washing vehicles, etc. Treating runoff is a third method, and that goes from filter strips, where they're just perpendicular to the channel, so that as the water is running into the bioswale, it gets a little bit of treatment through the grass before it gets actually down into the holding area. A conveyance swale, so that's not where you're infiltrating, but where the grass in a very shallow ditch then serves as the filter in the sponge, so that the pollutants can be absorbed by the grass instead of running into the creek. You see that in Snoqualmie Ridge, the parkway was designed with those conveyance swales. And then the level up beyond that is a biofiltration swale where you're actually holding the water and allowing some infiltration.
Mike, do you envision requirements for a connector class versus, you know, a more rural street? So that way we have some kind of standard that can, you know, is you don't have cobblestone over here and you have pervious pavement, you know, a block away. There's some kind of overall theme, I think, would be aesthetically pleasing to the city and the tourism aspect of it, but also create some kind of clear process that's easy to follow for different builders.
Yeah, we have our residential low-impact street standard now. What we don't really have is other street classification LID standards. So we do have the ability to do it on a case-by-case basis in Public Works Director's approval. And then another component is to infiltrate the runoff. So beyond filtering it and reducing impervious surface, you can take the water and just soak it into the ground right there. So on the small scale, you've got your rain gardens, which is more of a landscape interest focus. And that's kind of what you've seen out at the new Cedar Falls development. You can amend soils so that you can have large landscape areas that have greater infiltration capacity, essentially a giant sponge. And then on the very large engineered scale, you've got infiltration galleries where you can have a huge bed of rock that's just there to catch the water. Top that with grass or something so you can have a nice park, but it's a stormwater, got a great stormwater function.
And that type of system's in Tannerwood.
What's in that's a vault under there, isn't it? Is it a vault or is it just a
vault is the pre-treatment before it infiltrates. Separate the oils and the solids from the water, and the resulting clarifying water goes into the gallery for infiltration.
Okay, so it's more gallery than vault.
What do we have at the park?
Which park?
Torgerson
Park.
Yes.
All it is there is we've got some biofiltration swells and then an infiltration pond, surface infiltration into the ground.
But it's out of sight. I remember there's some kind of a wrap or some material that in the center between the two parking areas.
Yeah, that's sort of biofiltration treatment for the runoff from the parking lot itself.
Yeah.
And then it's piped over to where the climbing rock is.
Yeah.
And the area around the climbing rock is an infiltration.
That's right.
Pond area.
Okay.
So what all these features mean, though, is that you're just addressing the stormwater right on the site so that it's not going directly to the river, flooding during rain events, and directing runoff pollution to creeks and streams. So what are we doing right now? We've got our policies in place in our critical areas element in our stormwater management plan. We adopted the 2009 King County Surface Water Design Manual, which is pretty progressive in terms of dealing with stormwater runoff. We have a stormwater capital facilities charge that a certain amount is levied based on the amount of impervious surface that you have. So that serves as an incentive for developers to then reduce their amount of impervious surface. You have to pay less. And then we've got retention requirements in our clearing and grading regulations that require retaining a certain percentage of existing significant trees. So it's 30% of the trees on a residential site and 10% on a commercial site. And here's our illustrious planning commission. We did a field trip 2 years ago into Seattle, and you can see the outcome. We adopted a low impact street standard that's now in use in the new Cedar Falls development. And we've also got our LID demonstration project that's across the freeway at the Heartland property that takes that a step further to the placement of the homes, the landscaping, and even more minimized roadway width.
Do you have a schedule there on that project?
They're working on their submittal right now. They're working on the engineering, and they do anticipate submitting the preliminary plat submittal to us within the next few months.
Great.
So additional things to consider, and Ron, I wanted to ask you more about this, but I understand that this is through the requirement from the National Flood Insurance Program. As a result of a lawsuit by which the Fish and Wildlife Service required them to update the National Floodplain Development Regulations to address listed species, Chinook salmon and resident killer whales, to require the use of low-impact development techniques in floodplains. So that's something that will have to be amending in our floodplain development regulations and possibly our stormwater regulations. No?
No. It's already covered in our stormwater regs.
Okay.
So it's just mainly a policy issue that we'd have to amend. But we have everything in place to go ahead and do that.
Okay. So it's something that's going to be coming back to you, though, shortly. I think Jamie's working on that one. Another option is if we're trying to encourage more LID construction, would be possible reductions in the stormwater capital facilities charge based on achieving LID techniques specifically rather than just reduced impervious surface. And finally, one of the purposes of doing that LID demonstration plat across the freeway is to understand more about how it works, how it doesn't work, and how we need to tailor our regulations appropriately. So these are the policies then that we have proposed in our energy and sustainability elements addressing stormwater management. Can you all read that back there? The margin.
Do we have? We don't have in the FARs right now anything that would give relief from height restrictions for reducing the FAR. In other words, narrower, taller?
We allow increased FAR by meeting certain criteria. One of them is rain gardens. So you're talking about when you get to that height cap, you can't expand your FIR because you're limited by the height cap.
Right.
I think.
So if you think about a single lot or small, you may not be able to do very much.
Yeah.
And so if you wanted to incentivize overbuilding full lot width that they're allowed in a setback, we'd have to give relief from height.
Yeah, so that's another toolbox option that we should consider in these incentives. Your questions on it?
13.5 looks to be a significant issue.
Yeah.
Because the more of it that you have.
Yeah, we are going to have to programize our management of it.
Is there a vacuuming description that's different than a street sweeper?
There is apparently some kind of tool that you use to vacuum an LID or a porous paving surface.
It's literally a vacuum, yes. As a metro cleaner, as opposed to street sweeper.
Sweeping.
The sweeper has a vacuum system in it, but it only to suck up what the sweeper picks up.
Right.
And what they're looking at there is actually having something that goes over the pervious area and sucks air from that pervious surface or pervious material. And that it also sucks up loose material.
Why do I have a Stanley Steamer visual in my head? I know we're completing our purpose.
Maybe it's a good new business model, so you haven't run out your services.
So that would have an implication for the city either in its operations budget for services hired.
So we're not idling around there, you know. We're moving as we're sweeping, you know, or vacuuming.
New equipment requirement.
But that's the trade-off for not having to do all the piping and maintenance and stormwater ponds.
Well, speaking of, one of the things that I know that we've done with a lot of our regulations is putting maintenance onto the homeowner or an HOA. And that concerns me with LID features where you've got a highly engineered infiltration system and putting the burden on an unsophisticated or choice of words perhaps.
A
non-professional
frustrated,
right?
Just say frustrated.
Frustrated.
The minute you set on the bill, they're going to be frustrated.
Yeah, so that's certainly another management protocol we need to consider. I know there are provisions in our street standards, our LID street standards, that call for periodic maintenance and inspection.
We have a, to address like 13.5 there for protocols in our storm system, and in our city code, we have a provision to inspect private facilities, determine if they're being maintained properly, issue a letter of deficiency to the property owner and require them to do the proper maintenance on it. Otherwise, if they do not follow through with it, we have the ability to go on-site, do it ourselves, and then build them. If they don't pay, we can lean the property. So,
really?
You know, there are ways to enforce it, and there are provisions in our code to make sure that people are maintaining their systems. And you can basically put that vacuuming part in there as a very similar type of protocol.
As an example, in the Cedar Falls development, part of the preliminary plat conditions of that were a maintenance checklist and homeowners association guide as to the care and maintenance of the Pyle swales.
You got to know city government gets you.
So driving that down to a basic idea, property owner, commercial or residential, who chooses by some choice to put a pervious service in their drive area, parking lot or otherwise, the reliance on nature to make it clear so that the system continues to work, that's not the default. The default is we set up a system of programmed vacuuming of that surface and inspection of that surface by the city.
Or what you could do too is just say, like with our backflow prevention systems for water, that on an annual basis they're supposed to provide a letter of certification from a certified vacuumer that they have gone on site and done their maintenance.
And this doesn't represent a new burden to HOAs. It's just a different system. So right now, HOAs are responsible to maintain their stormwater ponds. Instead of maintaining their stormwater ponds, they're responsible to maintain the bioswales. So it's just a different system.
I don't know how much time we could spend on it. I'll just bring one more caveat to this. Privately, septic systems in King County are managed by an expert who's paid by the private citizen to come out annually, or whatever the period of time is, roughly annually, to inspect their septic tank, usually a couple $100 bill, and they report for a small fee to the county. That process requires somebody come into somebody else's backyard to inspect the system that has been working for how many ever years. So I think of this as a very far removed point that we have to consider as a private owner to say, hey, I don't need to have this thing inspected. It works or it doesn't. If it doesn't work, I'm going to fix it. And I'm just questioning, if I don't use my driveway, why would I have to schedule a vacuum process? If I don't have leaves and trees above my particular driveway, why would I have to have my driveway vacuum? So I'm just, you see where this goes.
We'll it's, do it systematically. It's developing the protocol.
Right. I can understand that. For something like this versus septic system. Septic system really doesn't have an impact on other property owners. And if it fails, it stinks up the yard, you know, whatever. But things like this, if the system fails because they didn't maintain it, the result is that maybe you're going to get runoff onto other people's property or into the street or what have you. So it's going to start affecting other property owners in the area. So the idea is to minimize the impact of failure on other citizens, other properties. So that's what.
Well, a couple things on this. Like with the backflow, I have to pay somebody to check my backflow every year. One of the problems with that is that not all backflow testers charge the same. I mean, it's a nominal fee for me, but there is some disparity between who does what. So forcing people to have to hire these outside folks, these outside businesses to come in to do these checks and services, there's no real checks and balances on those particular individuals and their fees. So, and maybe this is
an instrumentation.
Yeah, and so what? Maybe I'm answering my own question here, but if the city has the capability to do the vacuum, I know the city doesn't want to be in the business of actually vacuuming it, but I mean, when I lived in Montana, if you didn't shovel your walk and they had to come by and shovel it for you, they billed you for it. I mean, similar practice. If there's a relationship that can be carved, maybe liability would be the reason why not, between the city and people who are installing these pervious systems to actually do the routine maintenance and only have to pay the city whatever the city costs, that might be a friendly relationship and some sort of way to incentivize folks to do this. Because I can see people that have, you know, you're hiring a certified inspector to come out to check your porous ground in the vacuum. I can see certain costs starting to accrue and property owners not being very amenable or liking those particular bills. So I don't know if that's something to throw out on the table for consideration. Because frankly, I would like to pay somebody from city to check my backflow just because I know it's getting done right. Plus, I know I'm not getting screwed out of, you know, whatever fees.
But
Are the roads in Cedar Falls city owned?
Yeah.
Dorm facilities, HOA.
It's often the case that the storm facilities are still the HOA, even though the pipes that carry them there are in the right of way.
So is the HOA charging the city for the runoff from the streets?
I like the way you think. Excellent.
Part of the conditions of the plat approval is that they take on the responsibility for the runoff from the streets.
Do we have many HOAs that own the streets?
No.
I think you're going to get pushed. I'll just say it. I think you're going to get pushed back, and we did, all due respect, instinctively. This list got somebody's attention who's thinking about, wait a minute, I don't want to have my property managed by somebody else.
But it already is. They're already, HOAs are already having somebody come out to manage their stormwater ponds, to go and clean out the muck every couple of years, take the sediment out of the bottom.
I'm not sure that's a good argument for doing the next level.
Well, Art,
appreciate your point.
Here in the city, the HOA's responsible for the storm ponds. I thought those were city facilities.
Yeah, where are they?
They're responsible for, I'm sorry, say that again?
The storm ponds, traditional storm ponds here in the city.
They're all privately owned.
All private owned.
Really?
Yeah. There's one that the city owns, actually, and that's off of Ballarat on 4th Street. So the city owns that little pond there that treats the water from 4th Street runoff. The city now owns, unfortunately, but we inherited it from King County, the infiltration pond for Wood River. And then we just have the storm facilities on our own parks areas. But everything else is owned by private homeowners associations.
So will there be consideration for permitting fees and license, business licenses for people that would do performance type maintenance? My example here is that my current backflow tester is no longer, is not renewing her business license in the city. According to her, the price is raised and she's just not efficient for her to do it, so I have to find somebody else. But if we're going to have a relationship here between homeowners who want to do this and they're going to have to hire outside vendors to take care of this business, maybe those type of permitting processes and license fees and those type of things could be considered differently for stimulating this green movement.
Right.
Excuse me. So instead of just a blanket increase in certain licenses that people pay, if it's pertained within a green category, the permits and the fees are just different.
About city license.
Right. So then that will also keep a way to keep businesses that perform this maintenance in check, saying, well, we have to pay all these fees in order to perform business here. And then it's like, well, not really, because the city is not friendly towards your type of business, because we support this type of business. So I think a good point that you brought up here, we're starting to see a lot of different threads trickle away from here. I never thought about the maintenance of the actual roads in this greater detail, but
yeah.
And I apologize, I've got to go, but I'll just say something like that that requires an inspection periodically. They also discover a failure. And when the property owner learns that there's a failure, what's the repair? How's that going to happen? If my asphalt fails, I got to fix a hole in the ground. If this fails, am I redoing the entire surface because it's kind of connected? I'm just saying there's lots of questions about it. Maybe an awesome idea, but if we don't answer the fees and the cost and the long-term cost, people are not even going to get to the benefit conversation. And it's good that we're having this talk because the fact of the matter is, the more we scope this out now, it is a relationship, it is a contract with property owners and property developers. They're getting into it, not blindsided. Everything's up front. It's all expected. Like you say, we already have storm maintenance management and those type of agreements and relationships with property owners as this. So it's not really like a big stretch to say, look, if you want to go this route, there are certain incentives that we can offer, and here are the different areas where this can pay for you. Or at least to support you and encourage you to use these systems. So,
yeah.
So my point there is flipping it back around to your point that this is nothing new. These are things that we're putting in place, so everybody will be up front and hip for what's going on as we roll this out.
And this isn't a weird thing either. This is almost becoming the new norm.
Yeah.
So developments around the Puget Sound are going to this LED model.
Right.
So I'm sorry Jim had to leave, but I just wanted to offer, unfortunately I've had experience living in a few HOAs and paying the monthly one of my first ones was in Southern California, and we had an issue where the hillside was sloped and it was too severe, and so when you would get rains, it actually caused the hillside collapse into a few homes, and it was up to the homeowners association to then foot the bill to restabilize the hill. It wasn't a small cost, but it was a shared burden, and I can almost see that this is not something that would be out of the norm for a homeowners association to have to deal with the cost. It's a pill to swallow and it hurts, but it's not something that's abnormal for homeowners associations.
Yeah, I think a lot of, well, certainly some of my questions come from development background, but some of them I'm thinking more about the long term, the individual person going out and buying a beautiful home in Cedar Falls is not thinking about the long-term implications of those things on site, and I'm thinking more about the backlash that comes kind of later. It's kind of the experience of folks who had the lovely siding product that failed, it's kind of
hardy
LP.
Hardy
LP.
LP.
Yeah. LP.
Yeah,
I was like, what?
Exactly.
I have to re-side my entire condo complex. And I experienced that, talking about an HOA piece.
And that was one of the reasons that we put it into the preliminary plat conditions, that there be notification about the maintenance requirement, the applications.
Yeah, and I get that, and all those are very good things, and thank goodness those are there. It's just what is Joe homeowner really understand about what we've put on them.
I'm thinking about the resale of those properties. For example, I'm thinking, I've got a really long driveway. I'd like to do the pervious driveway, and all that's fine and dandy. I'm good with the maintenance that's required of it. But if I try to sell that home and that property, and now I've got a laundry list of maintenance and potential pitfalls for the next property owner.
May or may not.
It could be.
Part of this, and certainly where a lot of what Mike's been talking to, I think, is towards the public is seeking as well the greener feature. So who knows?
What's the impact on the folks who do not live in a development?
I would say they get a net positive impact because they're not dealing with the system-wide stormwater necessities that would come from a pipe system.
Except that there's no HOA to offer part of the cost.
Oh, you're talking about somebody that implements these features
on
it?
Because I don't live in a development. I don't live in an area that has development that has an HOA. Mm-hmm. And so the thing is the city's cost or the cost for maintaining it, that just adds to my cost of living.
So these features at this point are all optional. The city has an LID street standard as an option to our standard street standard. So there's nothing that we're requiring in this for the use of LID.
Particularly for the individual, most of these things almost don't apply. Not a lot of us build streets for a single lot, although we all have to get to it. It kind of depends on where your property is.
I just want to offer a closing thought that when I think about the potential development of the city and how it can be positively or negatively impacted, I would prefer these standards over existing curb, sidewalk, gutter systems. And when I think about where there's just nothing and developing with low impact standards versus traditional building standards, that the impact to the surrounding neighbors is going to be positive because there'll be less of an impact overall to the area and the groundwater and what goes on you know, as far as shared systems, unfortunately, the internet is still shared.
Okay.
Well, that's all that we have for that.
I would just like to add to what you said, that although there are some negative effects of doing these things, the people are always going to gripe, we're always going to have a problem with change, no matter what it is. I think that most people know something's got to be done. And pretty much nobody's going to do it unless we have to do it, you know? And so it's so obvious everywhere that we've got to do something. And so, I mean, we can't make everybody happy, you know? No matter what. If we can educate about the positive, you know, offer the education of why and help to educate the people, this is what you're getting.
Yeah, education is a really big component of the sustainability element, too, to let people know why it is that we're implementing and encouraging the light.
So here's your options. Would you rather have this or this? Now that you know what this is going to do for you in your city in the long run and right now, you know, do we have anything in place to educate the people of this town?
One of the things that we want to do along with this is to create a sustainability page of our website that goes more into the educational aspects of each of these components. So LID, energy savings, green building, waste reduction, and that'll be resources for people to connect out to outside sources for more information on how they can take part personally in achieving sustainability goals.
Final thoughts? I see you thinking.
Final thought. Encroaching governmental control over me and my house and the way I manage my property.
Well, that's also why we're showing a lot of this, nearly all of this, as incentives. We're not driving a hammer of regulation here. We're saying these are great things to do. Here's ways that we can encourage it to happen.
With a required annual inspection, that's an incentive?
But that's an optional.
That's if you take that alternative for that type of payment, right? Or you take the other. I think I look at it also as pretty much everything I do with my property is regulated in one sense or another, as is and has been forever. It's a matter about what type of regulation am I seeking, or what do I see as more favorable? You know, wiring, plumbing, the sewage, the building materials, the size that it is, how it is, you know, all of those things are regulated as it is, and so this is, as you say, these particular things are about incentives for things that we see as leading us to less impact to others, and still as a choice. Other?
Just wanted to say thank you guys very much for coming. Next month, same time, the second Thursday of the month, we're going to do a workshop on resource consumption, waste reduction, and recycling. Both as a municipality, our own operations, and in the community properly.
What's the date of that?
June 14th.
And before we do move to the next agenda, it'd be great if you'd each give your name and address so that we know who's been with us. We sure hope you come back next month as well.
My name is Tom Kemp. I live at 43119 Southeast North Penn Road.
Thanks, Tom.
I'm Sundy Preston, and I live at 237 West 2nd Street.
Super.
Yeah. Well, thank you both for coming. Helps a lot. Okay. Good work.
Alrighty.
Okay. agenda item 5, floodplain development plan. Ron, I'm betting you're going to introduce and
sit back.
Then sit back.
Gray and Osborne is the firm that has been helping us to put together our updated floodplain management plan because it's a we have to do the update because it's required by FEMA and the ISO, who sort of oversees our rating system on our flood system and our community rating system. So Gino has been doing the update for us, and Barry Baker is from Gino, who has been spearheading this. He has addressed the comments from the last go-around, provided a revised copy of the plan for all our previous comments, and is here to maybe summarize where the significant changes were and address the one issue that was brought up at the last meeting we had as to what type of effort might we have to go through to get our city to the next level of rating, to therefore increase the amount of credit on our, increase the reduction in the insurance rates for flood insurance. So I'll let him take the floor.
Okay.
Just before we jump into that,
sure.
Eric, could I again on the schedule, the tentative schedule, I'm a little confused. We've got floodplain development. We're hoping for a final recommendation tonight. On June 14th, intro hearing and recommendation floodplain development regulations for the National Flood Insurance Program amendments.
Two different things, and I can try to address that. One of them is the planning portion of it that is presented here before you tonight.
Okay.
The second one is one of those questions that you asked, what can we do to change our score? How you do that in your regulations and what you adopt or don't adopt will have an impact on that score. So the plan just basically says this is where you're at, this is what you could do, and then the next one is one of those options of what you could do. So is that sufficiently, that's from my perspective, I think that's where you're at on those two.
And that second part is also specific to that lawsuit that we were talking about for the protection of listed species. Mm-hmm. Right. So these are specific things that we have to do in response to that.
Yeah.
Okay. So that's to make sure that we become compliant with the NIMS, which is National Marine Fisheries Service suggested or desired requirements for individual cities to be compliant with the Endangered Species Act, and then FEMA is basically the one that sort of oversees all that stuff. So we're looking at a list of code changes to address those requests from NIMS.
Okay, thank you.
All right, I don't have as many pretty PowerPoint slides as what he had before. You guys have the plan before you. We tried to incorporate all the comments. I have seen them going back through it, but there are a couple of things that in formatting and doing the mail merges or the merges back and forth, that there are a couple figures that are not properly, they're just a bunch of question marks. So Word did not merge those properly. I will go back and fix those. There's a couple of other things that were incorrect as far as some typos. So I apologize for that up front. I think Ron has noted a number. I caught a couple when I was preparing for this, and so we will get those taken care of. If you have any others, we will certainly address that as well. But I just wanted to start off with that. In summary, what the purpose of this plan is to, as Ron said, make sure that you're compliant. And the real reason for the plan is that your city used to stop somewhere about there, and now it continues on significantly. And so
the main driving force, or one of the big driving forces on this, is simply additional area that's been annexed, and it, since it's now within the city, it needs to be incorporated within the plan. So because of that, the city contracted with Grant Osborne to do an update to an existing plan. You'll notice the formatting is a little bit different on this copy than what you had before as far as font type and different things like that. And that's because what we gave you before was literally the previous plan with some changes to it. But we didn't do all the formatting of the titles and the, you know, chapter titles and headings and things like that. With this revision, we have now done that, and you'll notice in some of the back of some of the chapters, you'll see table of contents started. That will eventually go away from what you see and be a table of contents in the front, but that's how Word develops it so that you can actually create that. So what you have is a draft still, but very, very close that it could be adopted if you've got any other questions that we can update. So there's a few formatting things that we want to do. And so because of that, we were not tasked with redoing everything. In other words, it wasn't a start from scratch. It was, you have a pretty good plan already, and to give you an idea of where that is at, if on page 1-11, table 1, gives you an idea of what community classes are. And this is what Ron was talking about the categories of where your rating is. The best rating you can get is a 1, the worst you can get is a 10, and these are basically discounts that you're able to do. So it's if you do more activities that protect your community, then you get a better insurance rate, is basically what it gets to be. You are, and there's one of those typos that didn't properly, you are currently a class 6. And one of the questions that was asked was, what would it take to get to a class 5? To go from, a class 6 has a 20% discount, a class 5 has a 25% discount, so it would be an additional 5% discount.
What are you, a class six. Class 6.
Yes.
And you said that's a 25% discount.
That is a 20%
discount. 20% discount. What's the 15% cited here mean?
Okay, I want to get into that in just a second. What that is of all the communities that participated in this program,
I remember tripping on that.
That there are 15% of all the communities that participate in this are a class 6, 5% are a class 5, so we might want to clear that up a little bit as far as the headings on the table. So what this really tells you is that you are already in the top 21% of the entire nation as far as your rating. So there's 15 at class 6, there's 5 at class 5, there's 1% at class 4, and then just a couple are class 2 and class 1. So you're already within the top quarter as far as your rating, as far as what you're doing. So,
and again, King County is class 2.
Yeah, King County is class 2. The vast majority of communities are probably class 7 and 8.
Is Mike or Ron, do you know what our last rating was? Was it either a 7 or a 5? Have we moved it all?
It was a 7.
It's been class 6.
It's been class 6.
Two ratings.
Yeah.
Which are, last rating was in 2005, and this current rating was in 2010. We were at the low end of class 5. We added some points the last go around.
Okay. Yeah.
So, and is it a 5-year cycle? So they rate every 5 years.
So, just to give you numbers, when this was done in 2005, your score was 2,077. To make it into a class 6, you have to be at least a 2,000. Right, so you just in. In 2010, your score was 2,321. So it increased by about 300 points, just shy of 300 points. So you're moving in the right direction. And to get to the next class, you have to get up to 2,500. So currently you're about 200 points shy of what it would take to get you up to the next class.
But between those two ratings, we got over halfway there.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. So there are, you know, the from our perspective, this is kind of a nice plan to update because you guys are already doing a lot of things right. It's kind of, it really is just an update. It's not large things. However, before we get too excited and patting ourselves on the back.
Let's go for class 3.
the way that you get the next set of points is going to be
perhaps more challenging. In other words, I think you have, for the most part, picked the low-hanging fruit. The places that you're going to really look at a lot of points is improvement for levee safety, for example, which would mean requiring that the levees be core certified, which they are currently not. Very expensive capital project. Ron did not want to give me the kind of budget that I would have liked to have had to tell you what it would have cost to do that. So I don't have dollar numbers for some of those activities. And that was simply because the purpose of this was to update, incorporate the annexation area and move forward and not spend a lot of money on something like this. We could.
And in some category like this, since we don't own the levees, they're owned by King County.
Right.
King County would be the ones that would upgrade the levee system, and we would have a basically a piggyback benefit on that. So we can get some points from them doing something.
Right.
But the cost-benefit ratio of redoing some of these levees out here is just astronomical right now. So,
so maybe this was explained before, but since King County owns the levees, how come it's working because of our rating system?
You have an option. It doesn't. They're not certified, and so you don't get any points for that. And the King County is the one who is responsible for them, so it's kind of out of
your
control.
I thought you were saying one of the hurdles to overcome is to reinforce the levees to make them core certified.
One way of getting more points would be to do that, but you don't own them,
right?
So then you have to go through.
King County would be happy to do it if we ponied up the money.
If you wanted to own them, I'm guessing King County would probably be more than happy to do things over.
Deed them over.
But then you'd be responsible for all maintenance and for all those sorts of things. And so
it's not that it's not working against us.
No.
No.
You're just not getting any points for it.
Right.
So it's a non-issue as far as you don't own them. There's not really anything you can do. Theoretically, you could. You could go get the levees and upgrade them. But
or relocate the homes out of them.
That is actually a separate activity, but yes, that would be another thing that you could do.
You're out of there.
I don't want to move.
You're out of there.
So that's one of the types of things and that you could do. You have a decent number of points. You've got currently 75. The average is 93 for flood warning systems. So you've upgraded that since last time. The maximum points that you can get on that are 255. Very few agencies have that, but that's the type of thing that you could do.
So do we need redundant systems or variant systems so we have multiple ways of warning people?
That would be the type of thing that would need to be done. And I can't tell you exactly how many points that you would put together. What Ron is, as your floodplain manager, would have to go through and actually put together an application based on that book. So it goes through and it says, okay, if you have, for example, a radio system, for warning, if you have a siren system, if you have, whatever it happens to be able to go through this, you send those in. Ron says, I think this is what we've got. This is what, and then they review it and give you the points.
And right now, Snoqualmie and North Bend share a radio system, so we both get points from that. We piggyback on the King County's warning system through the internet, so get some there.
The beacons in town, flashing
lights.
The beacon, that's part of our radio system.
Oh.
Yeah.
Didn't we talk last time about the air horn siren?
Yeah,
things?
We talked about
motion.
That. So. We can mount one on the car and go around town and say, warning, whatever. In the old-fashioned way, Mayberry RFD type thing.
Do we have one nice, juicy chart that breaks down the point system?
Visual
reference?
What I should probably do is include it. It is in a publication by the
floodplain,
by FEMA itself.
Would it benefit it to have it as a table in this? Does it change? Is it a static rating system or does it change?
It changed from 2005 to 2010. They changed some of the point systems in there.
Yeah. So perhaps as a reference document, but maybe not something we want in our.
One of the things that we could do is we could put this as an appendix.
Yeah. Oh,
yeah.
Right.
so that you would have simply this that gives you the community rating system as an appendix. It's a FEMA document. It's not part of yours per se, but you could reference that.
Yeah.
We talk about it in the text. We have some things that we discuss, but to answer your question, do we have? We do, but it's right here, and it's not yours. It's not part of the plan necessarily. But I'd be happy to put it as an appendix if that's what you guys would like.
Appendix makes sense. Yeah. And as long as we're on this table, so that the next time we see this, I don't ask the question again. I think it would be good if this table were broken into a couple of columns here, and that these percentages that are currently there be listed as percentage of cities or whatever the proper heading would be. And then I think the percentages of discount should be in a separate column. So, because that's obviously where I keep tripping.
Are you interested in seeing what your current scores are in that table as well? And I just want to know.
At first blush, I would say, yeah, call it out. But to his point, to build this table out, deconstruct a little bit better so it's visually clear, and then have a more clear legend for it so we can follow those data points. But I would like a 2012 earmarked somewhere on there. It's like, this is where we presently are.
Yeah, it's helpful to know.
It needs to range with it to have context.
Where we were,
So,
the next guy.
And then, is there a class 3?
Is there what?
Is there a class 3. Yeah. Yes.
Might well look at the same in it. There's no one in it.
Yeah, that's...
Hey, that should be our...
That is why it was not included in this table, is when we got the data from the national resources, there was no one in class 3. They were either in the class 2 or a class 4. So,
again, you trip poor, mentally challenged folks like me.
What's missing?
Class 3 and 0 makes more sense to me than it does... It's not...
And that's an excellent point, because when you see a small thing like that, even though it was intentionally left out, it looks like it could be an error, so then my mind immediately goes, what else is a mistake in this table?
Right.
Yeah.
And this represents nationally?
Nationally. This is national. Yes. We have a spreadsheet that's every state community. It's rather large. So that's really what we have as far as the plan. The other areas that you can look at is acquisition and relocation. You currently have no points for that. The average community has 213. You've got a maximum possible 3,200. But the reason why I'm sharing this with you is that is a policy decision that the city has to make. Is that something we're going to aggressively pursue or not?
You're talking about relocating buildings out of the floodplain.
Yes, acquiring and relocating them out of the floodplain.
Right.
The challenge that you have is where the town is and where it was built. I mean, I don't know any way, nice way to put it. North Bend's in the floodplain. You know, how?
Well, we're slowly buying upstream.
So that's the type of thing you can do. So anyways, I don't have anything necessarily beyond that. I'm more than happy to take any questions, comments, that you want to put in. My summary is that North Bend is doing certainly a better job than most communities within the United States, certainly better than many within Western Washington as well. Is there more you can do? Yes, there is. And, I've got a memo that's actually going to Ron of saying, these are the various things and I've talked about them here. That you could do the policy questions. So,
I just want to know real quick: is building elevation anything that will increase the points? So, if they're existing in the flood, that you raise them up.
Yes.
That would also gain some
points. If you have a code requirement that they have to be elevated to a certain level, now you have elevation certificates already.
We have a code requirement if they have to do. Building renovation that is 50% or more of the assessed value, then they have to raise the building.
And you're getting some points for that. So
would it make sense if we also put in there a flood event of such nature that we would require? So if they had a significant flood, where the normal one is a foot, if they had a 2 foot, where they're going to have significant damage anyway, that in order to rehabilitate that dwelling, we require an elevation.
Well, but it's driven by the construction review. The 50%.
50% is...
Right, so that would cover that scenario, because more than 50%
so much damage.
I mean, if it, you know, like the pictures you see out on the Mississippi, you know, if I sandbagged 6 feet high around the whole place, I might get zero flood damage. Just because the flood was 2 feet instead of 1 feet, you know, that would be a reversing the incentive.
When I was looking through this the other day, maybe this isn't appropriate for this type of document, but one thing that occurred to me would be nice to have a quick call out up front as to action, right? Like the course of action. Maybe the key findings are, in order to move from here to there, these are the steps that North Bend needs to consider. So that as I'm going through the introduction of it, I get a good indication, a good flavor, a good essence of our direction, so that each of the chapters, these sections, start making more sense to me. Just some sort of abstract or call out.
Specifically of the...
The community the areas systems that you could, you're talking could, about, right?
Yeah, areas of improvement.
Areas of improvement.
So within that section of community rating is where you'd be looking for that. So, Gary, beyond the comments that you were making about the community rating system and such, I wanted to be clear. Were you saying that's really all that you had intended to share tonight, or just that's what you were sharing about that, and then you have more to
say? That's really all that I had intended on sharing on this. And the primary reason is there is not really a lot of significant change between what you had as your document before and what is here now. You know, it's a... inch and a half document, and you know, we could go there's discussion of ESA and there's discussion of the National Marine Fisheries in the impacts of that, but you know, we've kind of covered it here. I don't know how much you want to go into that, but there's a lot of text there that
so that's where my direction lens itself is. Okay, we have a lot of text. I think we can table and chart some of this stuff out, but I don't have enough concrete examination of to give you a good direction on where and when, but I definitely think more charting and tabling would be helpful.
Well, we could do that. I guess the and I'm not trying to not answer, not do what you want to do. When we scoped this, we tried to. Ron didn't like the first budget I gave him.
Ron's never seen a budget he likes.
We like Ron.
And so, and that's a very good quality.
Yeah, good quality in that.
So what he said is, whoa, we're not rewriting it. We're just going to take what you got, we're going to update it, and then we're going to move forward from there. So that's what we tried to do. I can certainly, I have no problem updating, especially the first chapter, and getting that introduction, kind of the core things updated so we can see that. To redo the rest of it would be more work than you probably want to pay me for.
Go.
I mean, I feel like that we went through this in pretty good detail when, you know, the line by line, paragraph by paragraph of updating, and kind of gave our opinions of what we liked in formatting. And
yeah, we certainly did, and I'll tell you, I'm coming kind of torn and it's a forest for the trees thing. So I tripped right up front as soon as I open it up, and I find 5-6 typos on page one. I stop. I say, if I'm finding that much wrong on page one, I am not about to try and dig through the whole document and wonder what else is there. So then I try to get past that. And then the next thing I tripped on was, well, no table of contents. And I can't find the tables, and I can't find the table of figures. And we're referring to table 1.1, which we deleted last time, but the text is still in there. And so I know the tables are not up to date as far as their numbering. And so I'm tripping on fundamentals. And I'm, you know, so trying to get past that was difficult. and you know, I went to chapter 2, which reads as a pretty good opening for the whole document, but it's chapter 2. So, you know, chapter 1, the introduction.
Throw it away.
Well, I understand that, but I mean, I've got to say, so I read through chapter 1, introduction, leads off with purpose. And I read down through four paragraphs of purpose, and I did not find a purpose statement there at all.
Again,
it's all
coming
history.
Back to the problem of the original document and how much are we going to go spend a lot of money to perfect something.
Well, I don't know. I guess if I were Grant Osborne, and by the way, your name is on almost every page of it, which I don't know if that's appropriate for final city document.
And that's up to you guys, however you want it.
So I would be recommending that that gets pulled out of there. Okay. But the fact that you did this work, it is your professional work. It would seem you would want to have a little more checking of that QAQC. So. I can certainly provide a couple of suggested edits in the opening paragraph, but again, my main point there was that those opening paragraphs to me all belong in the background. It's all talking about the history of the document. There's not a purpose statement that I found, and again, I let it.
The purpose statement is on the third paragraph.
Purposes
of this flood hazard management plan amendment are to incorporate areas annexed into the city of North Bend from King County plan, address recent changes to the regulatory flood planning, and to update the plan in accordance with the new federal, state, and King County city regulations.
So the third sentence of the third paragraph is my purpose statement. So then I would say that should come to the first
paragraph.
and as I looked at those paragraphs. Yeah, I was getting that what is paragraph 2 looked to me to be the first of the history paragraphs. North Bend focuses on, and then what actually led off with the city of North Bend has until 2004 felt to me like the second paragraph. And I would suggest, and again, so... that particular paragraph, I'll make a suggested edit to you here, Gary. Instead of saying the city of North Bend has until 2004, I would suggest that the sentence leads until 2004, the city of North Bend managed the development of.
So, Rob, are you suggesting that the third paragraph, all of that goes up as the first paragraph, or?
I let the typos kind of dissuade me from going too far, but it would seem like the third sentence which starts the purpose of this flood plan would be sentence 1, and perhaps the first two sentences would follow that.
Yeah.
Right, so reversing that particular paragraph, but then that paragraph probably is
paragraph
1.
And then
followed by what is currently paragraph 2, followed by what is currently paragraph 1.
Just one clarification, though. What you're talking about that last paragraph about the purpose of this flood prevention plan, that's the amendment that's it's describing, and not the plan as itself. So maybe what you're looking for is a statement about the plan itself.
That's exactly what I'm looking for. What is this? Yeah, exactly. You're right, again, because I'm not reading for clarity here. If this is saying why we're doing this update, the first thing I want to know is why the heck do I have this whole thing to begin with? And I guess
why is it relevant
it was
to
if it was it was never there, I guess.
No.
Right?
It wasn't.
So I kind of need that. I'll give you one more suggested sentence edit, and then I'm going to stop with that kind of edit. It's again, I'm back on what is currently the first paragraph. Second sentence that leads off with the city compiled. I would suggest that the sentence should start in 2005. The city compiled all of these management tools. I don't think you need a comma there. Plus additional guiding principles into. And then here's where I don't know what the right word is, but I think it is into one. Whatever this document is called, it is, you know, in other words, this document is the result of that work, right? Mm-hmm. So whatever this document is, it would be guiding principles into 1X, comma, the 2005 floodplain management plan. And maybe that's just what it is. I was tripping on it. Felt like you were compiling it into a single document. And I don't know, maybe I'm going too deep on it.
Well, I guess what I'm not sure of is that the 2000 floodplain management plan is a document, and then this is an update of that, so this would be the 2012 floodplain management plan.
Again, which was part of, again, why to me that whole paragraph is history. Yes. It's not about the 2012, it's about 2005, but am I right about the way that I'm interpreting what that sentence is about? That it's saying that the city gathered all of these disparate pieces, put them together, and that became the 2005 plan.
Yes.
Plan, right?
Yes.
I mean, that's what I was trying to get to.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. And I've got a question on page 1.2 that the paragraph where it's talking about maps from North Bend comp plan, etc. I just tripped up a little bit. At one point it's talking about Silver Creek areas. It's talking about extending floodplain management plan coverage area to these areas allows the community rating system increase. And then later in the paragraph, where it starts its last sentence, says it should be noted here that North Bend is participating jurisdiction and in that way is eligible for FEMA public assistance. Both of those things seem to be talking about how we're getting eligible for FEMA assistance, and I wasn't sure, is it A, we're eligible for the public assistance because of having the management plan, or is it B, because we're a participating jurisdiction in King County, or is it both?
Because we're a co-signer to the King County All-Hazards Plan.
That's what gets us in?
That's what gets us in for getting FEMA money after a disaster.
Okay. Okay, and then extending that plan to the other areas gets them covered.
So that's not
rating system.
Not really. No, they're because they're part of our jurisdiction.
Okay. But then, Gary, to what you're saying, it the way Ron's explaining, yes, it sounds like it's out of order.
Yeah.
Public assistance is governed by us being part of the All Hazards Plan by King County. And that's any property within the city limits.
Right. So that's kind of the guiding piece of jurisdictional policy or whatever the right word is. I guess what Gary's saying is, the first thing is, because we're a participating jurisdiction, that's what's getting us covered.
Right.
Now we've updated this plan.
And that covers the additional area.
Even though it's technically covered, we're wanting to be sure it's all included. The piece I was talking about, Gary, about what was cut, the first sentence in under background, we had a table 1.1 that we deleted.
Yes.
And I believe that first sentence was intended to be deleted with it. Although it's a good sentence. Maybe we were just chopping the money out.
What I took from that comment was we're getting rid of the detail of the table with the breakdown because we didn't have sufficient information on the later floods because they weren't available for McKee County.
Okay, that's where I was going.
And that was a lot of where we got hung up on, but it was also because those figures were about King County as a whole. The dollars were attached to King County. Mm-hmm. And we're saying what we're trying to understand
just
here is what's happening to North Bend.
Yeah.
And so I don't know. And in fact, that's why I don't remember if we believe that there were. Is the sentence correct that there were 13 floods in North Bend, which North needs capitalized?
Yeah.
Or were there 13 floods on the Snoqualmie River, which could be all the way up to Snohomish County? Because the table was definitely talking about the entire river basin.
Yes, the table that was in there was the entire river basin.
Yeah, the $20.25 million, that was basically for the entire river,
yeah.
Not for
yeah.
the
yeah.
Snoqualmie County.
And that leads me to wonder, does therefore the 13 flood events is the entire basin, not necessarily the city of Coleman?
Yes. It would be within the entire basin. And so what you're saying, since it's the entire basin, it doesn't need to be part of this plan.
So strike that.
However,
was the 2008 flood in here? I don't remember seeing the 2008
yeah.
reference.
I mean, I'd love to have the reference to what's yeah. actually happened
yeah.
here. I
mean. Which is what we went round and round about.
Right.
How do we get that?
Well, what we couldn't come up with was the dollar figures. You do have a list, though, Ron, don't you, of how many events were considered for North Bend, or do we not even have it at that level?
Well, I saw there was something, I don't remember where it was at, but I want to say there was talk of some flow regulation citations of the rivers, and at certain points the flow was a certain level, but I could be wrong. I thought I read that in there. But I didn't see any reference to, say, like 2008, which was a big deal.
Right.
So maybe that would be one of those areas, instead of speaking to dollar amounts, we actually look at the actual scientific data of the different flows and the different heights, cresting, those type of things.
Yeah.
I just can't remember where it was. And
it was important back when we got the data on the flow rates itself.
Seven dash ten, Cloud Creek, Gregory Creek, Gregory Creek flows.
Maybe it was there, and I just don't recall jumping out.
No, that's sediment trap.
Sorry, the sediment trap. It should be.
Sorry.
Because I thought that was one of the most recent relevant ones, but I just don't recall it.
List of tables.
Yeah.
Right.
So it seems like a little bit more organization.
Yeah, support.
Okay.
I'm assuming part of what you caught, Gary, was at the top of 1.3 where there was a couple of question marks.
Yes.
And the last sentence in the second paragraph there is referencing Sideview as a newly annexed area.
And that's not. Animal Grove, that's right. Those were annexed earlier, as I recall.
Which page are you on?
I'm on 1.3.
Yes.
Second paragraph, last sentence. It's saying newly annexed areas. Sideview and Maloney Grove.
So that's just a carryover, I guess, from the
previous document.
Yeah.
Right.
Is that something that we need to start proofing on our end? Because I didn't think that, getting into that level of
doing.
Detail.
That's something we should be doing.
Was something that, okay.
Well, that was kind of where I was at. I get tripped on those
yeah,
things,
right.
And I didn't want to flip through and say, okay, this looks like we got it.
Right.
1.4, the committee. Mm-hmm. It, I don't know, again, this one may just be because of the carryover, but the committee, the Citizens Advisory Committee, end of the second paragraph under that says, since adoption on the plan, the CAC has been inactive. Is that committee technically still a standing committee, Ron, or is it long since dissolved?
I don't know if it had some sort of sunset clause in the formation, if it was only active for the formation of the original plan and then it would be dissolved, or whether or not they would be an active advisory committee to managing the entire floodplain. I think the initial intent was just for development of the flood plan itself. But people on the committee wanted to continue on, mm-hmm. but I think due to inactivity, we were in a building moratorium and nothing was happening,
mm-hmm.
it sort of waned and fell by the wayside.
Could you, I was concerned of us speaking to it as being inactive, which that implies that the committee does exist and would be recognized.
Well, I'm like, oh, cool, there's a citizen advisory committee.
Right. It seems like
the challenge you have is that is right. for a plan to meet the requirements for FEMA, it has to have a citizen. There has to be that committee that was input.
Okay.
We included this, and because that's a requirement, that there was one that was there for the development of the plan. This is an update, which doesn't necessarily require reconstituting of that group, but it had to be there for the actual development of the plan. So,
as an ongoing though? Are you saying that the ability to have that committee, dormant as it may be, to be able to call it together something required
for the development of the plan, first plan, not necessarily an update,
right.
But for the development of the plan. This is a requirement from FEMA.
Sure. It makes sense that it's in here, but I'm just saying to imply that the committee still exists and therefore has some authority sounds to me something you don't want, unless, in fact,
we need it.
It is there.
I don't know the answer to that. I know what's there is a true statement.
Yeah. where I think it's going is that if it's a requirement that we have to have this committee to be able to all of a sudden be called into action, if that's a fact, then I think it's easy enough for our council leadership to create that and make sure that we have that on those people on standby. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And that would be a good thing to be aware of. Because I understand your point. You know, they needed to be active then.
Yeah.
Okay. And we have to have the record that they were there. And so it says, yeah, they were there from here until then, until May, whatever it was, 2005.
Should just stop looking at this document. I was going to ask, 2-37, there's a call out there about Hurricane Floyd. I wasn't sure what relevance that had to us. Was it just intended to be a, hey, here's the kind of things we're talking about?
Yeah. You said 2-37?
237.
There was a number here.
Okay. So. Oh, the table is there.
All right. That little call out. I don't feel strongly about it, but it just didn't seem pertinent to us. Something that happens.
Well, there was mention of the Pineapple Express, so I'm wondering if there was any other recent climate tag names that have happened.
No, I mean that's just an example of of the impact of businesses by natural disasters. That's all that was.
As I was looking at that, I was looking at the actual critical facilities intended to be here. And with the pending new fire station, the last, the paragraph at the bottom, while public works complex, the fire station is the new fire station, would be outside. Right, Ron? So. Okay. I don't know if we say the old one or whatever. And then at least one of these cleaners is gone, although I don't know. Mountain Valley Center cleaners, they're still in business out there.
It gets back to your point, though, time-specific things.
Right.
Do we need to list these, that they're going to change in time? And can we just say dry cleaners generally? Or?
Yeah.
Just making categories.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I guess the only two things being cited there, well, no, that's not true.
Well, why aren't they just property-specific instead of business-specific, because they're talking about sites? It's because of what they store. It's
right.
The hazardous material that
right.
they store.
And that they're,
and so
they're in the floodplain,
yes.
and the type of thing they
yes.
have.
And at the time, they probably had to call out the specific businesses, I'm assuming.
Yeah.
But.
At any rate, I know one of those dry cleaners is on one.
It's the manual that I have here that points. It talks about the planning process here. It talks about involving the public in the planning process. And you get points for this.
Mm-hmm.
And the term public includes floodplain residents, the owners or managers of flood-prone properties, business leaders, civic groups, blah, 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 whatever. Credit points show the importance of involving the public in the planning process, especially as members of the planning committee. You
we
guys
are
the planning committee.
Right.
So it doesn't have to be a citizen action,
right.
Yes,
a formal CAC like we have back in 2005.
Right.
It's just a planning committee.
Right.
You guys
yeah,
qualify
it,
for it.
Well, yeah, and we've held the public hearing. So, I
yeah,
mean, it totally, to me, fits the intent. And so it just seems like acknowledging that committee was very important at the time, did great work, but it's ended, it's sunsetted.
Yeah. Maybe we can just put a statement in there that the role of the CAC has been taken up by the planning
committee.
There you go.
It's more relevance.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I'm stopping.
It's a lot to.
So I would ask commissioners their feeling on it.
My feeling is that there needs to be a little bit more organization than some just different call-out tactics. And clearly, you know, proofing part of it has to be adjusted. But I know we don't have the budget to include different. But if there are those types of sections where it would be helpful, then let's do it. So for the tables that we currently have in existing, if we detail those out a little bit better, then I'd like to see another version.
Okay. I agree, feeling the same way.
Yeah. Very. I feel like there's enough.
I trust in the editorial process, although you know, I feel pretty confident with the draft editor.
And I'm kind of the fence sitter. I mean, I came in saying, I want to see a finished document. understanding that it still needs to go through council, and can certainly clear up a lot of typos and things like that. But I guess the lack of the, you know, the table of contents and the strong lead gives me the sense of saying, no, I want to see a final where I can go, yep, this says table 2-1, and I find
yeah,
table
yeah.
2-1, and that's that
yeah.
actual
just
reference.
Just kind of a nice
you know.
Bow on it, that makes it easier for us to say, yeah, we feel better to pass it to council.
Yeah. Well, it has to be an intelligent, intuitive instrument.
Right. Yeah.
And just, I think our small exercise tonight has shown that it's not there yet. But I think the contents.
Yeah, the context.
So is it fair to do that, is to just, instead of doing the final recommendation or approval tonight, is get the cleanup version? It would be a pretty quick exercise.
Well, that's exactly, yeah, I'm thinking we lead with that at the next meeting, and it should be pretty fast. I mean, again, if it comes in and there's an opening and a table of contents and all that stuff, I think we're off and running pretty fast.
All right, we'll definitely put it ahead of transportation, so you've got incentive to get it done.
Yeah, exactly. Ron will never get to not be with us.
Ron likes hanging out with us on Thursday.
He's there.
He's got a little bit of
and, yeah.
All right.
With that, I'll entertain a motion to adjourn.
Motion to adjourn.
Second.
Motion to adjourn.
Second. All in favor?
Aye.
See you next round.
All right.
That's all. Thanks.
Thank you.